The Role of Faith, Part 2. The 19th talk in a series titled Biblical Philosophy, The Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 13, 2013 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 12 in this series.
Okay, next installment in the series on biblical philosophy, the message and worldview of the Bible, or subtitled, Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian. We began last week by talking about how the role that faith plays in a more typical kind of understanding of the faith, and then we began, in contrast, to talk about and develop what exactly is faith and how should we think about faith, what is the role of faith in the New Testament. So we're right in the middle of that. Someone came after last week and says I skipped over something, and would I please talk about it? So let me start with that. If you have the notes on page 3, the last part of point 2, I say in the notes, doubt is a very good thing when it is a function of my mind trying to resolve contradictions, anomalies, and other difficulties in my system of beliefs. And he wanted me to emphasize that, because probably if you spent very much time around Christian culture, you were certainly given the message one way or the other that don't you dare doubt. I mean, if doubt creeps into your mind, you might be on the verge of going to hell. So get rid of that. Get rid of that doubt. Put it aside. Deal with that and resolve it, because we can't have any doubts in our life. And as I was suggesting last week, where is that coming from? Ultimately, that's coming from a very long tradition that started way, way, way back in the early stages of Christianity, where I think because of the influence of Platonism, there may be other factors, but certainly the influence of Platonism had a role here, that we got the idea that God, being the most important thing that we can know, deserves to be known with the best kind of knowledge. And in Platonism, the best kind of knowledge, the only knowledge that really ultimately is truly knowledge, is a knowledge that is just absolutely certain. There is no room for doubt. And I remember as a child that thinking that the way that you deal with doubt is just by brute force. You know, you just tighten yourself up and squeeze out any doubt that might be entering into your brain. Just squeeze it out. Don't let it in there. Well, that's not faith. That's a weird kind of dogmatism. I'm going to believe it, and nobody can make me not believe it. I'm just going to believe it. Well, that's not at all what doubt is. Now, true, there is a kind of doubt that is basically throwing dust in your eyes. If you don't want to believe, if you are unwilling to believe and unwilling to be committed to the truth, then typically we human beings want to believe that we are somehow intellectually in the right to not believe. And so we'll try to make ourselves feel like the gospel, the claims of truth in the Bible, are somehow inadequate. And so we will create doubt in our own minds in order to justify our unbelief. That doubt is dangerous, because that doubt is the tip of an iceberg. It's symptomatic of something amiss deep down inside. I have some kind of moral, spiritual aversion to the truth, and I need to justify it, so things that should be clear are not going to look clear to me, and I make them not look clear to me. Human beings are fully capable of making themselves stupid, and we do that all the time. Things that ought to be clear, things that ought to be obvious, things that we clearly should believe, we find a way of thinking that there's just not enough evidence, not enough reasons, not enough good arguments for why I should believe that. So somehow I'm being responsible by not believing that which everybody knows I ought to believe. It's another way of calling good evil and evil good. But having said that, so doubt can be dangerous on the one hand. On the other hand, fundamentally, doubt is a God-given warning sign. When I'm going along trying to make sense out of reality, trying to make sense out of the world, trying to make sense out of God, trying to make sense out of Jesus and so on, and I'm putting this picture together, if the picture's not going together, the way the human mind tells me, Jack, this ain't working, that's what we call doubt. Doubt is that feeling, that sense, that intellectual experience where my mind is going, we need to try over, we need to start over because this is not working. And that's the best friend we have intellectually, is that kind of doubt. Now, it's not always fun. I remember going away to college and after flirting with a physics major for a year and a half, I ended up going into philosophy. And I would sit in philosophy classes and everything that I had absorbed from the Christian culture that I was a part of as a child was under serious attack by incredibly intelligent people who knew a lot. And I mean, I'd come out of a class feeling like I'd been in a prize fight, you know, just beat, pummeled to death by all these facts and information. And they weren't wrong, they were right. And that was the hard part, is I couldn't hold on to the faith that I had going into it in the face of the facts, the information, the truth, the knowledge that they were giving me. It just didn't work. It didn't fit. It didn't go together. And I can remember walking out of some of those classes, I'm not even sure I can describe it right now, but in emotional, psychological turmoil, because I was torn. On the one hand, something deep inside of me had hold of me and wasn't going to let go, and that is, I know this is the truth. Jesus is what this life is all about. I've got to know him. I've got to follow him. I've got to serve him. But in light of everything that I've just heard, I don't even know what that means any longer. What am I supposed to do? But what it prompted me to do is put me on a lifelong path of trying to figure out, if it's true, it's got to make sense. So I need to understand how it is that I'm supposed to understand this that makes sense. I was caught between my rationality, which was too inevitable for me to set aside and let go, and my conviction that Jesus was Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and I needed to serve him. Putting those together is the task of Christian discipleship, I think. You get to know Jesus by knowing the truth, but you can't know the truth by just arbitrarily believing some system. Any old system will do. Just because it has the name Jesus slapped across it doesn't make it true. And so that's the task that we have to engage in. Study our Bible, think, ponder, and understand the truth of the Bible in the light of the God-given reason that we have been given. Be intelligent about the way we read and understand the Bible, because that's going to lead us to truth. In that task, doubt is a good friend. And we are not doing ourselves any favor if every time doubt comes along, we just brush it aside and say, go away. Don't bug me. Don't bother me. If we want doubt to go away, answer it. Resolve it. Stay with it. Hang in there. It may take time. And you may have sleepless nights, and you may go through a lot of agony when you go. I mean, I thought my whole world was being turned upside down sometimes coming out of those classrooms. But it's the best thing that ever happened to me. And I thank God that he pummeled me to death like that. So that's what's behind my comment there, that doubt is a very good thing when it's a function of my mind trying to resolve the contradictions, anomalies, and difficulties in my system that I, in my belief system that I haven't been able to resolve. Okay, pressing on, a lot of this is going to be review from when we got into the conversation part last week, we covered a lot of this ground. So some of this will be review, but I'll try to be brief. My contention is that as a universal human experience, that what we believe is actually seldom strictly a matter of what my reason and my intelligence indicates to me is true. Rather, what usually looms larger for most human beings is what I want to believe. What I want to believe, I gravitate toward, and I only need a little excuse to be able to call it intelligent to believe that. I don't really need really good reasons, really compelling reasons, because we're driven by this want that is inside of us. We believe what we want to believe for the most part. And I was arguing last week that I don't think that's how God created us. I mean, he did create us to be beings who have this subterranean, unconscious, below the level of our awareness, set of desires and inclinations and wants and wishes and so on. I mean, that's just part of being a human being, and we've been made by God to be that. But I think what God intended for a noble human being, a godlike human being, a human being as God intended human beings to be, is while we have all those passions and inclinations within us, they're not supposed to rule us. They shouldn't be what's determinative in what I choose to embrace and call true and make my own. What should be determinative is what my intelligence tells me is true. Not that my intelligence is infallible. That's where doubt comes in. It's not infallible, but it's the only window on truth. It's the only avenue toward truth that God has given us, and we need to use it. So in God's created design, I believe, God intended for human reason and intelligence to always trump my own inclinations, whatever my wants and desires and inclinations might be. But unfortunately, most of us as human beings don't have the integrity to make that be the case. It takes a particularly mature, sanctified person, I think, for it to be the case that we will give preference to our reason and intelligence over whatever other emotional, psychological inclinations we might have. So, as we look around and go through the world and navigate human experience, most of us who are interacting with each other are people who are blown around by the various desires, inclinations, and wants that are inside of us. And then we commented on this a little bit last week. What is it that human beings typically do then? Part of us knows that we're supposed to be rational, but we lack confidence, we lack integrity, we lack confidence, we lack competence. And so there's all kinds of obstacles to us simply letting our reason bring us to truth. So what we substitute instead is what I call religious commitment. That we come up to a point and we decide, I've got to live my life somehow. I've got to think something. I have to have some kind of opinion, some kind of judgment about this thing. So we take a leap of faith where we just decide to plant both feet on this belief system or on this belief and call it good. And in order to gain some security for ourselves, we decide to make that a steadfast commitment, and we ain't going to budge. There's nothing that's going to move me off this commitment. That's what I'm calling a religious commitment. And oftentimes, in many subcultures, we reinforce that, we support that, we applaud that, and we praise that, especially in the context of our Christianity or our belief in God. We applaud people who make a religious commitment to God or to the gospel or to Jesus or whatever. My contention is, no, that religious commitment is a perversion. We are not to be religiously committed to anything, not to a sports team, not to a political candidate, not to a political ideology, not to a religious system, not to a religious doctrine, nothing. It is sort of subhuman to make a religious commitment to something. And the apostles and Jesus would never have recognized in the word faith what we put there, because typically that's what most of us usually mean by faith. Faith is when you've come to a point where you've made a religious commitment to something. And no fact is going to change your mind. No argument is going to change your mind. No different perspective is going to alter your thinking or change your mind. You are there and you are there to stay. And praise be to God, look how loyal you are to God or to Jesus or whatever. You're not going to budge. I would submit that's not a good thing. That's a bad thing. It's not a good thing in sports fandom. It's not, although relatively harmless, usually. It's not a good thing in politics. It's a terrible thing in politics. And it's worst of all in our religious beliefs, in our theology, and in our commitment to Jesus. What we are supposed to do is come to a level of intellectual confidence. We'll come to a point of confidence where we are convinced that the truth of the gospel is true, and out of that confidence, give our life to it. Stake our life on it. Stake my very existence on the truth of this thing that I have confidently come to know is true. That's what we're being called to in the Bible. Now, some of the things that were said to me growing up in Christian culture about faith, that would somehow praise faith for believing and being loyal to beliefs that obviously weren't true, and that somehow there was a greater virtue in believing things that obviously weren't true than there was in believing things that were true. So if all the evidence was against something and you somehow found a way to believe it anyway, my, what an incredible person of faith. No, that's an idiot. That's a fool. That's not someone to be applauded. That's someone to be pitied, because we are setting aside the very avenue to truth that God created in us. We're setting that aside and replacing it with a perversion, this kind of false loyalty. So from my perspective, we should never practice religious commitment in any area of our lives, and certainly not in the context of theology and doctrine. Okay, I sort of jumped over a lot of notes there and took it all in. I think I've covered all of that. So to summarize, then, in human experience, what a person believes may reflect either of one of two things: one, what his intelligence tells him the evidence points to, that is, if he's allowing his intelligence to dictate his belief, then what he believes points to what his intelligence tells him that the evidence says is true. Or his belief may reflect what his inner desires and passions and wants prefer to be true. And that's if he's giving greater weight on his insides, on his passions and desires. Now, with that in mind, here's how we understand what Jesus and the apostles are teaching. The most important, the most powerful, and the universal non-rational factor that works on all of us human beings in relation to our belief about God is our innate rebellion against God. The last thing we want to do naturally is bow the knee to our Creator. It goes against everything in us as perverse, depraved sinners. We really don't want to go there. And notice I'm using the word want. We don't want to go there. So that's the biggest obstacle, then, to belief in Jesus, is those of we creatures who are inclined to not really do what our mind says to do anyway, but would rather do what we want to do. What is it that we want to do as sinful, depraved sinners? Well, we don't want to bow the knee to Jesus. We don't want to listen to him. We don't want to submit to him. We don't want to submit to God. That stuff I'm allergic to that, and I don't want that. So to understand the New Testament, we have to understand that from their perspective, that's the natural response of a human being, not only to God, but to the gospel itself. That's our natural response, is to stiff arm it, reject it, deny it, and refuse it because we don't want it. We don't like it. So what does that mean? The Bible assumes, of course, that the teaching of Jesus is true. And it assumes that the teaching of Jesus is rationally compelling. He raised from the dead. He performed all the miracles that the disciples saw him perform. He had voices out of heaven, God himself speaking, saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." That the actual eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus had evidence piled upon evidence, piled upon evidence, piled upon evidence, saying, "This ain't no ordinary dude. He claims to be the one sent from God. He's that." God has pulled out all the stops to verify that and validate his claim. So the evidence points to the truth of who Jesus is and what he taught. So why would someone not believe it? Well, really, from the biblical perspective, it seems to me, there's only three options for why you would not believe that Jesus is the Messiah. One is ignorance. And I'll come back and discuss each of these in a second. A second is some kind of psycho-emotional hesitancy. Some kind of psycho-emotional obstacle of some kind. And the third one is the native, innate spiritual rebellion that every human being begins with. All three of those could explain why we may not believe in Jesus. So let's start with ignorance. We're well aware of the fact that as history is gone, not every human being everywhere in the world in human history has been confronted with the same level of understanding that you and I have been. You could probably go into the Amazon and find a Stone Age tribe in the, I assume they're still Stone Age. I mean, maybe, I don't know. But find some tribal people in the Amazon who don't know about Jesus or know very, very, very little about Jesus and about, they don't know about Abraham. They don't know about Moses. They don't know about the Jews. They don't know about Jesus. They don't know about nothing. Are they damned? Are they condemned? Is God going to destroy them because they're ignorant? No, nothing in the Bible would ever suggest that God would do such a thing. He may condemn them, but he's not going to condemn them because they're ignorant. He's going to condemn them because they're like you and me, because they're innately depraved and in rebellion against their Creator. But what if the Spirit of God has invaded the life of one of these Stone Age tribesmen? And has begun to woo his heart to honor the Creator, to serve the Creator, to love the Creator. He doesn't know much about God except that he's the Creator, the one who made the monkeys and the banana trees and whatever. But that's all he knows, but he knows that much. And he begins to respond to that, out of that level of knowledge, by seeking to know that Creator and to know that God. Why would he be doing that? Because the Spirit of God is drawing him to himself, just as the Spirit of God has been drawing you and me to himself. Why do we believe what we believe? Because God has invaded our life and has begun to draw us to himself. It's not what you know, it's why you know it that makes you a child of God. So ignorance is no obstacle to God adopting a human creature as his own, as his son, drawing him to himself and giving him whatever level of knowledge God sees fit to give that person. And that's God's business. God is not going to condemn someone just because they don't talk the way you and I talk about God. Now, why does the Bible not talk about that? Well, in a way it does, actually. It does talk about that because you go to Hebrews chapter 11. I'm sorry, I might be repeating myself from last week, but you go to chapters 11 and it talks about all these people who are justified in God's eyes, who are dikaios in God's eyes because of their faith, of their belief. And one of the first guys out of the bat is Enoch. And Paul mentions, and then there is Enoch. who walked with God, and then he was no more. And you can almost see Paul worrying about this. Okay, now, what did Enoch do? How did he evidence any belief? Because Enoch was before Abraham. I mean, he doesn't know nothing. And all the text says is he walked with God, and he was no more. And what that means is he's one of those rare individuals in human history who didn't die. They just sort of got beamed up. So Enoch was beamed up because he walked with God. Well, Paul is sort of worrying about that. Well, what exactly was he was doing that would make him dikaios in God's eyes? And that's when he follows that with, no one can please God unless he knows that God is and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. And I think by implication what he's saying is, well, at the very least, Enoch had to know that God is and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. That must be the sense in which he walked with God, or at least that. So the Bible is not ignorant of such a situation, or not silent, I should say, of such a situation where ignorance is in play. And in the case of Enoch, it takes an ignorant man and puts him in the hall of fame of people who believed and were therefore justified by that belief. But apart from certain passages like that, for the most part, you read the New Testament and it keeps saying, if you believe, you'll be saved. If you don't believe, you won't be saved. If you believe in Jesus, you'll be saved. If you don't believe in Jesus, you won't be saved. Jesus saying to people, if you believe in me, you will be saved. If you don't believe in me, you won't be saved. If you deny me, I will deny you. If you confess me, I will confess you. But if you deny me, I will deny you. So it's easy to see why we would get the impression that this very specific content of believing in Jesus himself is absolutely essential, or God can't grant you mercy, because the New Testament seems to be full of that kind of thing. But that's where we have to be careful. We have to take into account the literature of the New Testament is written by a particular group of people to a particular group of people. Jesus is speaking to a particular group of people when he walked the earth, and the apostles are writing to specific groups of people. And their audience is not the Stone Age tribesmen in the Amazon. That's not their audience. Their audience are people within in Judea who have heard all about Jesus. Ignorance is not their problem. And it's to those people who he knows have the knowledge that he says, if you deny me, I'm going to deny you. In other words, unbelief is not failure to believe. Unbelief is refusal to believe. Unbelief is denying and stiff-arming the truth that has slapped me in the face. It's not never having been slapped in the face. It's God's job, it's God's business, whether or not we get the information. But what all of us need to do is to respond to that information rightly, appropriately, by submitting to the truth that I've been confronted with. Okay, well, that's ignorance. Ignorance does not condemn you. It may explain why you don't believe in Jesus, but it doesn't necessarily condemn you. And notice I said necessarily. Most people who are ignorant are also condemned. But the reason they're condemned is because they're human beings who are not interested in God, who are allergic to God, allergic to truth, allergic to everything. And they're condemned for their rebellion. There's another possibility that's at least a logical possibility. And that is that one is unwilling to believe in Jesus and his teaching because of some kind of psycho-emotional factor. Let me give you an example. Suppose you are a Jew who for your whole life has been acculturated to associate Jesus with Hitler. Doesn't matter whether it makes sense. That's just a fixture in your psyche. Jesus is Hitler. Hitler is Jesus. It would be unthinkable to you to think that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sent Hitler into the world to be his Messiah. I mean, why would you find that plausible? Of course you wouldn't find that plausible. So if a Jew who can't even get to first base to think about the actual biblical claims about Jesus, because there's this psycho-emotional block that just every time someone says Jesus, a picture of Hitler comes into his purview, does that condemn him? I would think not necessarily. Now, you know, that all this stuff is ultimately God is going to be the judge. It's God who decides all this stuff. It's God who knows the heart. We don't know that. But at least in theory, can you see how a psycho-emotional block may prevent you from embracing and believing what's true without condemning you? Because the only thing that condemns a human being is the unforgivable sin of rejecting the truth about Jesus. Well, he's not rejecting, this person arguably may not, is arguably not rejecting the truth about Jesus. It's just never even getting close enough for him to even make a decision, to even confront the truth about Jesus. But again, that's not the typical case. That's a relatively unusual case. That's not the typical case. The typical case, and that's the typical case that is what's in view in everything that Jesus and the apostles write, is that we're unwilling to believe in Jesus because of our rebellion, the hardness of our heart, our depravity, our perversion. We're not going to believe because the rebel against God in me doesn't want to believe. I don't want to. And I'll find any way I can to justify not believing. That's the unbelief that is always in view in the New Testament. So I think the mistake that's been made by so many different Christian traditions is they see all the emphasis on believing in Jesus in the Bible, and they jump to the conclusion that belief in Jesus is an absolute condition for receiving mercy from God. But if you read the New Testament carefully, the Bible itself is not proposing it as an absolute condition for receiving mercy from God. It's the typical condition that is met by those people who are going to receive mercy from God. It's not absolutely the case in every life, but it is typically the case in most people's lives. Well, that's a big difference. And yet, too many Christian traditions try to absolutize that, and then they get themselves into all kinds of weird theological knots. I remember being at a conference once where a president of a conservative Baptist seminary was the speaker, and he was making the case that somebody had asked the question, you know, what about somebody in the Philippines who's never heard of Christ? Why would God condemn them? And his contention was, if someone turns their heart toward God and is receptive to God and wants to know God and wants to love God, God will send a special visitation by Jesus to that person so that that guy can believe in Jesus. I mean, even at the time, I mean, I didn't know much at the time, but even at the time, something in me said, really? Really? God's going to send Jesus in all these special visits to confront them one-on-one in order, simply because we can't bend on the claim that you have to believe in Jesus to be saved. We can't nuance that at all. We can't reconsider that. We can't qualify that in any way at all. That is absolute. Well, okay, you can go there, but there's nothing in the Bible that would encourage you to absolutize that. What do you do with Enoch then? What do you do with Abraham then? Abraham, who's the father of our faith, would not have qualified according to this seminary professor. At least, well, I mean, I know what he would have said. Abraham got a visit from Jesus. I mean, I know that's what he would have said. He would have had to have said that. But what an odd thing to believe. What a truly odd thing to believe. Only because we are so inflexible about that which we have absolutized. It just makes a whole lot more sense to rethink whether or not it is absolute or not. maybe God works in a number of different ways in the lives of a number of different human creatures throughout all of human history. That's what makes more sense to me. So, now I'll stop here in a second and let you have at me. Point 7 on page 7. Hence, when the Bible teaches us that the one who believes in Jesus will be saved, it is intending to suggest that the one who has ceased his rebellion against God is the one who will be saved. That's really what it's getting at. It's not my belief in Jesus as such that marks me off as someone who's going to receive mercy. It's what that represents. It's what that indicates. It's what that is symptomatic of. And what is it symptomatic of? I've laid down my arms. And I've said, God, I'm not going to fight you any longer. You're the creator. I'm a creature. You have every right to make of my existence what you want to make of my existence. And I want you to do that. I'm not going to fight it any longer. And this thing about Jesus who you sent in the world, yeah, it's true. He is your Messiah and he is my king, and I will serve him and I will honor him. It's that willingness, that openness, that receptivity, that contriteness, yea, even brokenness, if you will. It's that brokenness before God where I'm no longer meeting him and his truth with the hard edge of my defiance. I've decided to give that up. That's why we're saved. That's why we get mercy. And that will either manifest itself in the context of the gospel being proclaimed to us, and what will, having put down my arms and become open and receptive, what will that look like then? I'll believe the gospel. I'll believe it's true. I'll recognize that it's true. Why wouldn't I recognize it's true? But if it's not in the context of the gospel being proclaimed, then it will show itself some other way, as it did in Enoch and Abraham and Moses and all the other children of God throughout all of history, who in their own time and place and context, the one thing they all had in common is they were open to God and the things of God. They were receptive to it. Okay, I think I've, in a fairly random and unsystematic way, covered all that. So let me open it up to your comments or questions.
I waited a few seconds, but nobody raised their hand, okay. So I guess I'll go. I'd like to take you back to a little bit earlier when you were talking about rationality, what our intelligence tells us versus our desire.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you said is exactly right if you can get on your wavelength and understand the way you're using your terms and what you're talking about. So I'm not disagreeing with anything you said, but it strikes me that it's tricky. I mean, let me propose something here and see how you would respond. I think I know how you would respond, but when you talk about going where the evidence takes us and our rationality takes us as opposed to what we want to be true, I think it's easy to imagine a situation where I'm saying, I shouldn't believe anything. See, I already know that you don't believe this because last week you said, and you've said many times, but I don't really have any right to believe anything unless I can mount a rational defense for every aspect of what I think. So I can imagine thinking, well, I've heard all of these arguments about evolution or something, and I don't have an answer to that stuff. So I would like to believe Christianity is true, but I don't have an answer to evolution, so I should just admit that I don't know and give up my faith in Christianity until I can answer every objection that an evolutionist might raise, or something like that.
Right.
It seems to me there's another aspect to that when we talk about our desires, that our desires enter into our rationality. That is, there are healthy and reasonable desires, that if I could wander around far enough into all of the things that have led to them, they are rooted in truth. So as I am looking at the worldviews around me and embracing one, I might embrace the Christian worldview in part out of, desires like I want to find meaning, and if I were to explore it far enough, I could give a rational defense for why.
Sorry, what's the word you use?
Meaning, you know, purpose.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. I guess what I'm saying is I can have desires that are true and rational and defensible that enter into the reason that I chose one way of looking at it rather than another. And I might not be able to give a rational defense of everything that I believe, but this worldview makes more sense to me in part because of what I want. And the thing is, the thing that I want is a good thing. I should be wanting that. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I do think I mentioned it last week that when I'm sanctified entirely, not just my mind, but all that inner stuff that I'm talking about that plays a big role, that needs to be realigned and reoriented. I need to love what ought to be loved, and I need to delight in what ought to be delighted in, and perverse loves and perverse delights need to be set aside. And that's all, yeah, absolutely, that's all part of the process. I realize I could probably sound like what I'm saying is we need to become robotic Spock-like people. I believe in Jesus. I don't really care. I mean, but it's true. So I believe in Jesus. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. I mean, we're human beings and we're going to be human beings, and we can't remove the fact that there's this component of passion, that there's these non-rational factors, and they're either right and good and valuable or not. And that's the process of sanctification, is they're going to become that. Now, we do have to be careful. I do think that there are people, for example, in Christianity, who are attracted to it aesthetically, and I'm not sure they believe it. There are people I've met who I don't think they're believers, but they're all about being Christians because it is so beautiful, I mean, in some sense. Now, there's nothing wrong with responding to something beautiful if you can see God the other side of the beautiful, and if you can love God through the beautiful. But there's some people who are so aesthetic that they get stuck on the beautiful period, on the delight to the senses, or the delight of the aesthetic, and they don't see the truth behind it. I don't even think they're believers. I mean, I'm not in a position to judge, but one suspects that they don't really get it by other things they say and choices they make and other things that they do and so on. So, yes, I mean, you're right. If I'm rightly aligned, my mind, well, and I think in part, the way we are wired is my mind, my feelings, my passions, my desires, my longings and so on are going to take their cues from what I believe is true. And when that happens, then I'm going to become integrated. What I know is true is what I also want to be true, is what I love, is what I delight in, is what I find fulfillment in, and so on. So, no, absolutely. I don't mean in any way to try to say we need to root that out of our lives, because far from it.
Right. And that's, I like what you said there about our emotions and desires being rooted in our beliefs. I think that's right, but all I'm saying at that spot is that many of my beliefs are not, I can't go back and exactly articulate for you how I got to all of those true beliefs. Right. So I can have true emotions based on true beliefs that I could not write a paper exactly defending exactly how that stuff came together.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
You talked about religious feeling at the beginning.
Religious commitment?
Commitment. Okay. Yep. And there have been several times where someone's come along and said, the things that you're believing aren't correct. I was defending your positions.
They're saying that about me?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they say,
really?
So this isn't right. And they give me a whole bunch of scripture places and real genuine Christian people who just disagree with you.
Sure.
And then a while, and I wasn't able to defend your position adequately. And then a few months back, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was like, yeah, the Bible was written in about 280. And I was like, well, I assumed it was written earlier than that, but I didn't have any way of backing up that I believed that. And those sound like the religious commitments that you were talking about at the beginning.
Namely, a belief that it was written earlier? You mean, sounds like it could be a religious commitment?
Right, so I'm committed to the things that you say. It's uh-huh. good because they're all coherent, as far as I can tell. But I can't back them up.
Yeah. Not backing them up is not the issue. I mean, that's kind of what Ron is introducing. And that we talked about a little bit last week, that so much of what we know, we don't know that we know. That doesn't make it not rational. And it doesn't mean it's not rooted in rational confidence. It's just that we can't retrieve it and express it in words and articulate it in a way that we could teach somebody else or persuade somebody else or convince somebody else. But it's still legitimate knowledge. And we mustn't discount that. I mean, most of the important stuff we know kind of intuitively. We don't. It's just really weird people like me who really like to spend our days figuring out what's down there and putting words to it. But most of us don't live that way. And that's fine. It doesn't make it not rational and an intellectual commitment. So not being able to defend it is not the issue. The issue is, what if someone, if I were you, I mean, I've spent my whole life here, is my first response is, you got an agenda to the other person, the person who's saying what you think is true is not true, this other thing is true. Yeah, well, what's your agenda? I mean, I tend to be skeptical. I tend to be, yeah, even cynical at times, that I know the human heart, and I know the human heart gravitates toward lies and untruths, things that are not factually true, things that are not intellectually compelling. They gravitate toward that because anything that would allow them to remain some kind of social respectability and still not believe, I'm interested in. And that's just the way human beings are. So when someone comes along to me and tells me, here's one of the reasons I don't believe, that's not interesting to me. What I'm interested in, what's true, not why you don't believe. So my first response would be, okay, maybe you know something I don't know, and maybe you're making this stuff up. I'll wait and see. So I shelve it. I don't respond at all. I just shelve it for now. But hopefully it's piqued my interest enough. I mean, that's what happened to me in college. I mean, that was the first time I got confronted with the idea that maybe the people that we say wrote the books of the Bible didn't even write them, and God isn't even responsible for the Bible. It's people and not God. I mean, I was introduced to that for the first time, really, in college. I couldn't answer it right away, but I wasn't ready to dismiss it either. And what I mean by that is, I think you have an agenda, and I don't think what you're saying is true, but if what you're saying is true, that shakes the foundation of my whole world. I need to know. It's critical that I determine whether what you're saying is true or not. And so then I'm on the lookout for, how am I going to do that? How am I going to know one way or the other whether that's true? And immediately I start paying attention, and I realize there's two groups of people, all of whom are intelligent, knowledgeable, well-read academics. Some say they're full of it, and the others say they're full of it. Okay, I'm not going to see that on authority, so I'm going to have to sort through the evidence myself and the reasoning that these people give, the data that they give, and so on. And over time, I'm going to need to form my own opinion, reach my own conclusion, because I can't just lend my mind to somebody else and say, you think for me, you make up your mind for me. I don't trust you guys enough for that. I don't trust you because I know you're like me. You have this incredible inclination to buy propaganda and support what you want to believe with propaganda rather than get a fact or a truth and embrace that because it's a fact and it's true. So I'm on my own there. I need to sort out for myself what's true and what's propaganda.
That's true. That makes sense. I trust you, and I think most of us trust you. And when I first heard your views. They were different from what I grew up with. And I talked to my people back home, and they were like, nope, don't listen to him. Listen to us. And it's because of a lot of the reason that I trust you is because of the way that I've seen your character displayed and the way you treat the students and everything. And so that's what that is a lot of what I base my beliefs on, is the amount that I've heard you talk and the coherence of your views. And not because I've gone and searched out to figure out when the Bible was written and stuff.
Well, that's okay too. I mean, I was helped tremendously by there are two people who had a huge impact in my life. One was Ray Steadman from Peninsula Bible Church back in the 60s, and then another pastor at that church, David Roper. And, you know, at one point, I just trusted implicitly everything that Ray said. And it's because I trusted the man. Now, today, there's probably not all that much left where what he taught and what I believe that we share in common, that's not true. That's really not true. I mean, the core is really still very much held in common. But around the edges of it, he really had a pretty different doctrine and theology that I do. I still trust the man, and I still trust his relationship with God. But, you know, the more I can see what shaped his thinking, I don't trust the forces, the influences that shaped his thinking. So all that's to say, I was given a tremendous head start in understanding the Bible because I listened to him and because I learned from him and because I thought along with him and so on. So there's nothing wrong with trusting people up to a point, but realize that people are fallible. So just because you basically trust somebody doesn't mean that everything they say is true. So I would hope that you don't trust me in that way, because what's shaping my thinking? Some of that stuff may be really, really wrong and really false, and I will be the last person to see it, and you'll see it quicker than I do, and that's as it should be. So I would hope that part of what it means to trust me is that, unlike your friends back home, I would never tell you not to listen to them. And I would hope that that's why you trust me, is because I'm not trying to sell you a bill of goods. If what I'm saying doesn't make sense, I don't want you to believe it. I would never want you to believe it. But hear me out, and if it makes sense, then consider the possibility that this is right, this is true, and we ought to believe it.
Can you tell me the difference between the religious commitment and my trust of you?
A religious commitment, there's nobody can say nothing that's going to make you disagree with Jack. That's a religious commitment. You know, you're staking your life here, you're grounding, you're sticking both feet here, and you are not going to be budged no matter what. But if you're simply confident that what I'm saying makes sense, then first of all, you know, is your confidence in me, or is your confidence in the coherence of what it is that I'm saying? I mean, if it's in the coherence of what I'm saying, it's not really even trust in a person. It's, this makes sense to me. And you can explain why it makes sense to you. You may not be able to argue it and defend it as if you had arrived at it yourself, but you can still explain to other people, this is why this makes sense to me.
I recently had this weird experience. I had an opportunity to go back, and this is going to sound really embarrassing. When I was a kid, I read all that UFO stuff, right? And I've sort of followed that movement.
Hey, bro.
I've sort of followed that movement over the years, and it's evolved into a religion. You know, crystal skulls and ancient astronauts and aliens overseeing human civilization development, giving us technologies. I mean, it's really well developed. And I recently had a chance to look over a broad survey of that presentation and then see it critiqued by someone who really took a strong scientific approach to it, right? And it's mostly lies, misdirection, conveniently leaving out information. I mean, it's all less than a house of cards. And yet, There are devotees. Mm-hmm. There are families of devotees. And as I processed through this, I had this experience that this was the most fascinating and intriguing and attractive lie that I know of. I could feel what I went through as a young man, you know, mm-hmm. exposing myself to this. And it's, I believe it's only by the grace of God that I never made a commitment to believe it. You know, there was something silly or just blasphemous about it that I think saved me. And I look out there at people that gleefully, happily embrace lies of any sort. That was the one I recently experienced. And it's like I feel like I was born an addict. And my addiction has just been looking around for its fix. When I remember my exposure to that sort of thing. And yet, it would not compel me to commit genocide or be cruel to my wife or engage in animal cruelty or steal or any of that. I mean, it would just simply be a fantasy alternative to the simple, bold truth that God is our maker and Jesus is our Lord. And so that whatever circuit that is in my brain that God has short-circuited to protect me is operating in billions of people's minds still. And yet they're relatively civilized. You would think, I mean, well, there's a whole Islamic movement that is not at all civilized, and it's a different kind of a lie. Mm-hmm. But why is it that some of those lies reduce us to animals? Brutal, selfish, vicious persons. And some of them turn us all into Tinkerbell. You know? what's going on with that? And I mean, it's at that level of rationality where your neighbor's a nice guy. You know, you'd have him look in on your house when you're gone, but he hates Jesus.
Yeah.
He don't want to hear about it. Doesn't care about it. It's not interesting to him. What, I don't know what, I mean, it's just hitting me recently because of what I just reexamined. I just feel helpless before that power.
Well, right, exactly. I don't have an answer to why it is the way that it is. But we are helpless. Paul has a great passage just like in 2 Corinthians. Paul's talking about his ministry. Therefore, since we have this ministry as we receive mercy, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves as your bondservants for Jesus' sake, and so on. The thing that's so interesting about that is he recognizes the temptation, of course, is to take the responsibility to get someone believing. And whenever we take on that responsibility and not recognize it's going to take a miracle for any human being to believe, because the God of this world has blinded their eyes. They are veiled. And unless that veil is removed, there's no way in the world they're going to see and no way they're going to believe. But when we forget that or ignore that, we think, well, if I just evangelize right, if I just present it right, if I just say it right, if I just say it with the right kind of love, if I just say it whatever, then that's going to break through and they're going to become believers. But Paul recognizes that actually what that does is it makes us deceitful. He says, we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God. It's been a long time, but I think that word adulterating is... I shouldn't say. I don't remember. Somewhere in here, he uses the word for peddling. You know, he's not peddling. He's not a snake oil salesman. But we can become snake oil salesmen and try to sell Jesus by refashioning Jesus into the form that we think they will buy. That's not by the manifestation of truth commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God, which is what Paul says, that's what I insist on. I'm not going to peddle this to you. I'm not going to adjust it for your comfort. I'm not going to make it attractive to you. I'm just going to tell you what's true. And if God is calling you miraculously to himself, you'll respond to that. So all that's to say, but we are helpless. There's no way in the world I'm going to be able to break through the hardness and the blindness and the veil over the eyes of a person by my efforts, by my devices. It's a miracle. So all we can do is keep talking, and one day, out of utter amazement, find out they've started listening. Any final comment? Okay, we'll finish this next week.